Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. Joining me here on the line for today's episode, glad to welcome back Senior Asset Allocation Strategist for the Americas from the UBS Chief Investment Office, Paul Hsiao. Paul is joining us to talk about the latest iteration of the ongoing series CEO Macro Briefing Book. For today, we will cover the Q2 update, which is now available for you, our listeners, up on UBS.com/CIO. So with that, Paul, good morning. Welcome back, and thank you for dropping by Top of the Morning today.
Dan, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, Paul, since we last spoke a couple of months ago at this point, can you bring our listeners, our clients up to speed in terms of how the business environment has changed, evolved from Q1? What have you picked up on?
Yeah. So when we published the Q1 report back in February, I think the top of February right now, At the time, we had certainly some geopolitical tremors still, the effects of the tariffs going on, as well as some friction in Europe regarding Greenland. And then ever since then, obviously, we've had the Iran war, which is a much more direct connection to the economy and asset prices through oil prices. So we thought at the start of the year, barring more geopolitical conflict, the U.S. economy looked like in pretty good shape. We thought there'd be a slight deceleration from the speed that the U.S. economy is growing back in 2024 and 2025. In 2026, we expected something closer to trend as the Fed leadership hands off from Jay Powell to Kevin Warsh, and that would set up the conditions for a couple more rate cuts at the end of the year, since the effects from tariffs, the inflation effects from tariffs would roll off during the first half of this year. And then as the economy continues to modestly decline, we thought that set the conditions for two more rate cuts. Since then, we've definitely had some developments that were unexpected. I mentioned the Iran war up top, which has a stagflationary effect to the U.S. economy. Right now, we're not seeing that in quite the data right now. We like to open up the Macro Briefing Book report with a scatter plot of where inflation is and where the latest quarter of GDP forecasts is. And right now we're squarely in reflation territory, where we have been for the last 2 years. We thought that the Iran war, with its increase in oil-related prices, could push us into stagflation, slowing down growth while keeping inflation high. But data from the Fed has suggested that the U.S. has been much more insulated to oil-related shocks since over the last 20 years that it's become an oil exporter. So it certainly is a challenge in the U.S., as it is across the world, with higher energy prices and no seeming end in sight. At the same time, the U.S. is a much better prepared economy than others to weather this. So underlying all that, we've had the consumer confidence still decline to recessionary levels, and we start to see its effect on a slowdown in overall spending, particularly in discretionary areas that are highly exposed to oil prices, like foreign travel and airfare. That has been lagging this year so far compared to years prior. And the labor market, which has been showing more signs of slowdown during the back half of 2025, that actually has been relatively surprising, which is a negative for the Fed. Headline jobs growth over the last 3 months has been the fastest in the couple of years. The unemployment rate remains stable, so there's less fear of AI-related layoffs. And with inflation remaining a little higher than target, it sets up the conditions right now for the Fed to pause their rate-cutting exercise, and we think they'll resume in the back half of the year, especially if we get more clarity on the Iran front.
So accounting for higher energy prices, current economic conditions, a fluid geopolitical environment, there's a lot out there to keep business owners up at night. So, Paul, as we look ahead a bit, I know coming up in November, we do have the highly anticipated U.S. midterm elections. I know you cover the Fed a bit as we're recording here on Tuesday, May 12th, just days away from current chairman Jerome Powell concluding his tenure as chairman. We have Kevin Warsh expected to come in shortly thereafter. So when you think about the upcoming midterm elections and more near-term, a Kevin Warsh-led Fed, how should business owners be thinking about these considerations?
Maybe I'll start in the Fed first, because to me, that's a little more clear-cut. So Warsh has been confirmed by the Senate. We've had, I think, Jay Powell's last press conference last time where he was asked whether he'd stay on, and he said he would, which shows that there's be a continuity of leadership at the Fed, even though the chair of the Fed might be rotating seats. But the overall composition remains still similar, and there has been less pressure from the White House to pursue criminal investigations over Jay Powell. So those are all good things for the Fed's interdependence and general autonomy. During Kevin Warsh's testimony, he brought up the fact that he likes trimmed mean PCE as his preferred inflation gauge, and that has been declining since it tends to strip out the more volatile components like oil, which is having effect on higher prices. So what that means to us and to business owners is that the structural dovish bias of the Fed, I think it's still intact, and that's why we're more confident on two more rate cuts by the end of the year, and that is more dovish than consensus, at least right now. When it comes to the midterms, I think if you look at a different prediction markets, they would say that Democrats have about a virtually sure thing when it gets to the House, and about 50-50 when it comes to the Senate, which means a very divided government for the White House. We think that the likelihood of the Democrats taking both the House and Senate to be less than 50-50. We looked at the electoral map, and what would happen is that the Dems need to win all their seats, which are in solid Democratic right now, the three seats which are in lean Democratic, the three toss-up seats where there's about a 50-50 chance, and then take one leaning Republican seat. So that's a really tall order for Democrats to have to get the majority of the Senate. So what that means for us is that even with a divided House, it would make compromise a much more pertinent issue for the White House, which has been enjoying a control of the House and Senate right now. It might make a government shutdown a little more frequent if the House can't come to agreements to pass certain pieces of legislature. But when it comes to the Senate, I think the more important thing there is personnel. So the Senate has the ability to confirm cabinet-level appointments as well as more higher-ranking appointments. Right now, the Republicans have it, and they also have the tie-breaking vote of the Vice President's J.D. Vance. But if Democrats are able to get a majority, that could certainly make more confirmations a little more difficult for the White House. So that's the major difference between what we consider to be the base case of just the Democrats taking the House and then the, let's say, upside Democrat case where they take both the House and Senate. The major difference for us there is the confirmation of personnel over Trump's next 2 years, and that might be a little more difficult. When it comes to passing legislation, just given the increasing attention that the bond market has on the U.S. Debt trajectory, even Warsh's own comments about the unsustainability of the fiscal trajectory, and even more, I'd say more sort of layman perspective of how much U.S. debt has increased over the years, I think it makes it a little more difficult for any more pro-spending legislation to be passed in the second half of President Trump's term.
Now, I want to revisit before we close out, Paul. You did bring up AI, artificial intelligence, a bit earlier in context to potential impacts, influence to the U.S. labor market. More broadly speaking, are you seeing any evidence or growing evidence of AI influence on U.S. economic activity?
Yeah, certainly. That's something that has changed from the first quarter to the second quarter. AI still plays a pretty major part in not only the U.S. economy, but the global economy. And it's spread out in a couple of ways. First, you obviously have the GDP impact from the positive impact of more data center or AI-related spending, and that's showing up in private investment, and that's helping support growth not only at the back half of 2025, but so far in 2026. And with hyperscalers like your Googles, Metas, Amazons pledging hundreds of billion dollars for CapEx this year, we think that that's still a positive story for the overall U.S. economy. On the flip side of that equation, we have some GDP detraction just based on the amounts of imports that are coming in that these companies need, computer imports, raw materials, and that is increasingly difficult if you have more tariffs or trade restrictions put into place, making further AI related data spending a little more difficult. And when it comes to financial markets, what we're seeing is, while the Mag 7 certainly has done well, equity started to broaden out. And so the CIO had this thesis where the first leg of the AI trade will have the enablers really benefiting. So those folks building those CapEx centers, building the picks and shovels. And we think that the next leg of the AI trade will help broaden the overall performance of U.S. equities in particular, based on those companies who are adopting AI to increase their productivity and margins. And we see finance, healthcare, utilities to some extent being the lowest hanging fruits for this sector. Over the CEO macro briefing book, we also have a couple of AI related slides when it comes to the labor market, where we try to take a deeper dive into, you know, is AI having a detrimental effect on the labor market? And right now we're seeing, if there is any effect, just a very, very modest for younger cohorts of highly exposed AI sectors. For other sectors that are less high touch point with AI, we're not seeing that as much. And we also have AI-related numbers when it comes to productivity, as well as GDP spending in the macroeconomic section. But before I close out, I just wanted to touch on AI in deal making. So I mentioned how AI is certainly a big player when it comes to not only the U.S. economy, but public markets. In private markets, in M&As, we're seeing not only more M&A deals related to AI come to fruition, but more M&A practitioners saying that they're using AI to source deals. And then finally, in venture, we've been seeing for a while now how AI is taking more than half of all venture fundraising dollars. And I think that that trend will continue to remain the case. Although I think the focus more now is on, you know, what's the differentiator of certain firms going to do, and what can these firms really do with AI enhancing capabilities that they weren't able to do before. So a little more scrutiny on that front from my perspective.
Paul, very insightful conversation as always. Thank you for dropping by Top of the Morning to keep our listeners, our clients informed on the deal-making environment, what you're picking up on with respect to economic activity, among some other timely topics. And again, I do want to point you, our listeners, to the latest CEO Macro Briefing Book presentation, the Q2 update, which is available for you now up on ubs.com/CIO. Though again, today we have been joined by Senior Asset Allocation Strategist for the Americas from the UBS Chief Investment Office, Paul Hsiao. Paul, thank you again for dropping by, and I look forward to picking back up with our conversation again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.